weather today in the Grand.
I love you so badly, I could.
They're solid plastic, so don't settle for imitation.
But the senator, while insisting he was not intoxicated, could not explain his nudity.
Good evening, this is Claire Steiner, and this is the Best of an Alan Smithy podcast. You give us 66 minutes and we'll give you 66 minutes of words. Who else can turn lasers into light shows, aircraft into armchairs, and high-tech into hijinks, all without destroying the world? From the 7th of March, 2012, it's a funny 80s teen sci-fi movie double feature, in 1985 to be precise. Except not Back to the Future, no, not Back to the Future. Instead, this episode compares Martha Coolidge's real genius to Jonathan Abutel's science project.
Hi everyone, welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for about an hour. Or we do commentary tracks, whatever. This week we're doing a good movie and a bad movie double feature. And that good movie is, both these movies have something in common, as is often the case. They're both about young geniuses, and they're both comedies, and they came out in 1985. The good movie is Real Genius, directed by Martha Coolidge and starring Val Kilmer, and the bad movie is My Science Project, which is probably one of the more obscure movies that we've done, and it was... written and directed by the writer of The Last Starfighter. I don't know what else to say about it. He didn't have many directorial credits. His name is Jonathan Arbuckle. And we're going to start out with the good flick, Real Genius. So it's been a while since I've seen this. I probably haven't seen this, maybe like almost in 10 years, actually. And I remember kind of liking it at, you know, when I last saw it, and I kind of like it now. My opinion hasn't grown. My opinion of it hasn't raised or diminished at all. It's just pretty good. And but some people really love this movie, and I can kind of get why. I mean, especially like in the context that it was made. I mean, I remember when we did Revenge of the Nerds, we were talking about how like Revenge of the Nerds paved the way for movies like Real Genius, and the music is actually by the same guy, Thomas Newman. But in any case, it's kind of like, you know, these are the movies that started to come out. I mean, not that many, not at first, but this was like one of the forebears where like, yeah, the main characters are supposed to be kind of eccentric, super smart geeks, basically, except, you know, it wasn't a cool thing to be called a geek then. But I mean, you don't, without Real Genius, you don't have, well, even something as idiotic as Hackers, but also not even something like, Wes Anderson's Rushmore, to pick another example. And Val Kilmer kind of, you know, he's kind of like playing the Bill Murray archetype of like 80s comedies, where he's just, you know, the lovable goof off who, you know, is always annoying authority figures and sticking up for the underdogs and stuff. But, you know, then the movie like takes it to the direction where, okay, he's also a genius. He's also super smart. I mean, it's funny, the movie's called Real Genius, but they don't walk around calling each other geniuses. They just talk about like how high their scores are. Oh, and you know, for people who haven't seen this movie, basically it's like a high school kid or a 15-year-old like gets to go to MIT or some MIT like college, and he meets up with Val Kilmer, and Val Kilmer is like the cool, you know, young genius who doesn't let his being super smart make him a nerd. He's instead an eccentric, you know, well, he's an eccentric, let's just put it at that. An eccentric rebel rather than a nerd. And there's even this, you know, heart-to-heart scene where he's, you know, saying to the young kid who's played by Gabriel Jarrett. He's saying, like, I used to be like you, and, you know, I used to let my my nerdiness run my life, but then I realized that being smart doesn't have to make you a nerd, basically. And, you know, it's kind of like an elaboration on the spirit of Revenge of the Nerds. And it even has a little bit of sincerity in it. I mean, there's some sincerity in the relationship between Val Kilmer's character and Gabriel Jarrett's character, I think. But there's also a little sincerity in the character of Jordan, played by Michelle Mernick.
Who's actually in Revenge of the Nerds at some point, I believe.
Oh, yeah, you pointed that out. So, yeah, I mean, there's some sincerity in her character because, like, she is a very realistically written, weird girl. You know, weird, super smart, kind of Aspie before they knew what to call it. Obsessive, compulsive, you know, nerd girl, you know. But she's more of like a true-to-life character than, I don't know, the nerd girl in Revenge of the Nerds who Anthony Edwards starts going out with. And, you know, that really gives Real Genius, you know, some, I don't know, it gives it a heart, you know, for lack of a less cliched term. The only thing that I don't really like about this movie is the plot, actually. because it opens with this, you know, big plot set up about how these bad Pentagon guys want to, you know, create a Star Wars-esque space laser, and they're going to contract it to this professor at the MIT-type school played by William Atherton. And William Atherton gets Val Kilmer and Gabriel Jarrett et al. To work on this laser without them knowing that it's for, you know, national defense. And when they find out about it, they're quite ticked, and, you know, then they get a kind of goofy, prankish revenge on him at the end. But yeah, the whole all the plot around this the development of this laser thing is just kind of dumb, and it just kind of feels like they put it in there because they needed to have a plot, and it couldn't just be a character study about these you know, these kids at this MIT type school. So, you know, it bogs the movie down, but It doesn't ruin it. And I also don't like it because it justifies a budget for, like, expensive laser special effects, which makes some kind of sense because it's a movie about lasers, sure, but whenever a lasery special effect shows up in the movie, you're just like, wow, that cost a lot of money, and that takes me out of this, you know, the drama between, like, Gabriel Jarrett and Michelle Mayrink. Is it Mayrink?
Mayrink, yeah.
Okay, let's just go with Mayrink. But anyways, you know, cast all around is great. Val Kilmer's got, you know, dozens of quippy, funny lines, and yeah, you know, it does have occasional moments of sincerity and warmth. So it's good. I still, you know, enjoy it. It's not – some people, I mean, really, I was talking to a guy recently. It's like, this is like one of his favorite movies, and I can kind of see how it can be somebody's favorite movie for sure. But, you know, even if it's not your favorite movie, it's still a pretty good movie.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with the science or the sort of laser stuff is that it's I mean, the movie's really, it's got a really strange structure because you meet Val Kilmer early on, and I've always wondered if they cut a lot of it because who's in it? I've never seen Valley Girl.
Yeah, me neither.
But that was that was like a big hit of
yeah, also directed by Martha Coolidge.
Martha Coolidge
just prior and to this, yeah.
Valley Girl is in this movie. I can't even remember her name off the top of my head. Deborah Foreman is in this movie, and she's in it for about 5 minutes. She plays the general's daughter, and it's just her weird little appearance, and it makes you wonder if something got cut. And it's just got a really so you meet Val Kilmer early on, but then you meet the William Atherton, you meet Gabe Jarrett, and then for about an hour, it's just about them at school, like, and he meets the girl, and it's really cool, and then they bring in the whole laser thing again, and it just sort of feels like...
Yeah, and the last half hour it turns into, like, sneakers or something.
Yeah, and it's like, and in the last half hour, there's still a lot of really subtle parts of it, but it just feels like, I don't know how it could be longer. I mean, it's not particularly short. It's 108 minutes. I wonder if it was originally over 2 hours and they just freaked out about it.
Well, isn't there like a director's cut out there?
No, not that I know of. Let's see. Okay. Alternate versions. No. There's a pan and scan. IMDb only talks about pan and scan and the TV version being more appropriate when it comes to talking about Jesus or something. But yeah, it was a big bomb. I mean, I didn't see this movie until after I knew who Vilmos Zsigmond was, so I got excited when I saw his name. So, I mean, I probably saw this when I was, like, 17 or 18. And it's just... I mean, special effects aren't great. I mean, that's one of the things with it, is that it's... You can tell it's somebody who doesn't know how to do special effects doing the latest special effects technology. And I wonder, considering it opened a year after Ghostbusters, if they somehow thought this was going to...
Well, because William Atherton,
like, did they get William Atherton post Ghostbusters? And I think they must have, because Ghostbusters opened in June of 84, and this opened in August. So that's enough time to get Atherton in there, because he didn't play the Ghostbusters type character before Ghostbusters, and that's all he's played since Ghostbusters. So
yeah, well, I didn't even recognize him until I looked at his IMDb page and realized that I've seen William Atherton in like 24 movies, including, of course, as Walter Peck, the EPA asshole from Ghostbusters. But, you know, you shave that beard off of him, and I don't know, I wouldn't recognize him on the street as Walter Peck. I did just see The Day of the Locust, though, which stars William Atherton, oddly enough, coincidentally enough, and that's a great movie. But, William Atherton, he's been in a lot of stuff over the years and hasn't really gotten any credit for it. But in any case, I mean, whatever. The role he plays in this is just kind of whatever. It's a really generic part.
Yeah, I mean, he's funny in it. It's not a particularly awesome role. What else did he do? He did
He was in Die Hard, I see.
Yeah, Die Hard, he plays
Walter
Peck. Yeah, he plays Walter Peck. That's basically Walter Peck. But no, before Day of the Locust, he was in Sugarland Express. He was in Spielberg's first movie. And it's a total... just don't even recognize, you know, what he sort of turned into with all of his... what he got stuck in. And he's sort of actually, I think...
I see he was also the crazy fella in Looking for Mr. Goodbar.
Yeah, he... what was that show, Life? I think he was on that and he was pretty good. He wasn't doing the same old Atherton that everybody got used to. I mean, one of the jokey stories about William Atherton is Mallrats.
Yeah.
Kevin Smith wanted him as the dad in Mallrats that Michael Rooker ended up playing. And he was like, I don't do that kind of stuff anymore. That's stupid. And then the next thing he did was Biodome with Pauly Shore.
Oh, boy.
And so, yeah, it was just kind of... I think it looks like he tries to be more respectable on TV and then, you know, takes the movie money when he can do a... But yeah, so it's weird to see Real Genius now. It's always... So I first saw it probably after Val Kilmer had been Batman, right? So, but now watching it again, now that Val Kilmer is... When's the last theatrical release he had? I mean, like...
Oh, I don't know. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I don't know.
Yeah, the last headlining. So it's just weird to see him.
Yeah. You know who is pretty good? Their rival at the school. I can't remember who the actor is, but who's he played by?
What is it?
Robert
Prescott as Kent. Yes.
Yeah, he's a great kind of dick, and you really, like, you know, for that for that hour that you mentioned where you're just kind of getting to know the people at the school and what it's like there. It's like awesome to see, you know, him be like the, cause he's a nerd, but he's like the bully of the nerds, which is hilarious. Like,
yeah.
he's the asshole nerd who picks on other nerds. And, you just wish that the rest of the movie could just be like that. But, you know, they tie him into the plot by having him, you know, like originally Val Kilmer's in charge of building this laser, but then it goes over to Kent. So, they tie him into the plot that way. And they do, you know, it's a very 80s. I mean, you know, let's not forget this movie was co-written by the guys who wrote Police Academy. There's a very there's a very gimmicky 80s kind of gag involving them putting, you know, like, what is it, fillings in his teeth that make him hear radio signals so they can broadcast to him, and they start talking to him in the voice of God and making him think that God's talking to him. I mean, that's a pretty good joke. But, you know, they have to tie it into the plot to have him, like, do certain things to get the laser to work or not work.
Yeah, there's a line in the movie that is, oh, Val Kilmer's talking about Kent to the Gabe Jarrett guy. And he's like, I once walked in on him eating Jell-O.
Oh, in his underwear?
In his underwear in a bathtub. And every time I rewatch this movie, I think it's a scene because it's such a weird image. It's such a horrific image, and Val Kilmer's so good delivering it.
Yeah.
Well, that's this thing with its exposition, it does a really good job with it. It's kind of shocking how good the dialogue is, considering it's Neil Israel and Pratt Proft from
yeah. Of Police Academy and Bachelor Party and,
yeah.
moving violations.
And then, you know, you look up the Peter Torkoli guy, and he's not Torkov-y, and he's not much better. So it's kind of weird to see, and it's like, did Martha Coolidge just know how to get it to work? I mean, Brian Grazer produced it. I think it's pre-Image days, but Brian Grazer produced it. But yeah, if you look at Neil Israel and Pat Proft's career... Ugh. I mean,
yeah, it's dreadful. They never made anything this good again, or had anything to do with anything this good again. Although, I don't know. I haven't seen Tunnel Vision. I can't speak for it.
Yeah,
yet.
I was just like, what's Tunnel Vision? Oh, they
Tunnel.
One of them.
It's one of those. It's one of those post Kentucky Fried movie. Actually, might even be slightly pre Kentucky Fried movie, kind of zany sketch movies, post SNL sketch movies. Let's call them.
Okay. Yeah. So. And then, yeah, if you look at their IMDb, it's basically just filled with they're getting credit for creating the Police Academy characters.
Yeah.
And then there was a Bachelor Party 2, which I somehow missed. Yeah, so these guys, it's – I think that
– you'd like to think that Val Kilmer improvised a lot of his lines because –
Did you
just
read
so quippy.
The IMDb trivia about his casting session?
No.
Okay, so where is this? It's really funny. Where is it? Maybe it's on Wikipedia. But it's cited now? Yes, it is. He says that when Brian Grazer auditioned him, he brought in, Val Kilmer brought in candy bar, or no, wait, hold on. There's a dispute about it, and it's from the, wow, it's from Entertainment Weekly back in 95, talking about Val Kilmer when they were hyping Batman. And he came in and he said, Val Kilmer recalls that he went in, he shook his hand, and Grazer said, hi, I'm the producer. And Kilmer says, he said, I'm sorry, you look like you're 12 years old. I like to work with men. And so, I mean, this is the whole, I mean, it's really sad now because we're into the point where Val Kilmer basically will appear in anything as long as it's filmed, you know, 20 minutes from his house in Arizona. But Val Kilmer was a, you know, classically trained New York actor. So It's kind of like, what if Dustin Hoffman were a, you know, teenage heartthrob and went in and caused trouble like he did on, what was it, Marathon Man? I guess Dustin Hoffman he got into a lot of odd situations with Laurence Olivier because the two of them completely disagreed on an approach to acting. So it's like,
right.
I think that's what brings some of it to real genius. And that's what makes it. Yeah. Today, just today, a friend of mine posted, you know, it's one of his favorite 80s movies or something like that.
It's a lot of people's favorite, one of their favorite 80s movies.
And
yeah.
It's just like, yeah. And it's most people haven't seen it. So it's just,
but the few who have, it's one of their favorite 80s movies.
And it's got a really good supporting cast. I mean, even when we go lower than Kent, basically the only cast that you don't remember is the military subplot. But Kent's right. sidekicks, those guys are yeah. memorable. Because, you know, because they're at science school, they all have, you know, some weird sort of tiny side story going. So it's...
Yeah, and then there's John Grease as the guy who's living in the steam tunnels under the college, because he was an obsessive student who never left, and at one point Val Kilmer has to caution Gabe Jarrett not to become John Grease, and you know, it's John Grease doesn't have a lot of good lines in this movie, but he's always weird looking, so
yeah,
he's got that going for him. And actually, that was probably the one thing that I really remembered for some reason, like when I saw this 10 years ago, like when I was thinking about Real Genius leading up to watching it again, I just thought of the scene of, like, you know, John Grease sitting in his automatic chair that's like sliding down the steam tunnels on some chairlift. But, you know, that happens fairly early on in the movie. And so, well, what else about Real Genius? Val Kilmer's I Heart Toxic Waste shirt is kind of iconic. I think it's because, like, the original poster was him, like, it's Val Kilmer sitting cross-legged on a desk and, like, balancing a globe or something on his finger, and he's got the shirt that says I Heart Toxic Waste. Oh, and he had another iconic shirt in this movie, the one that says Surf Nicaragua. I think that one's been copied quite a few times in real life, much like Booger's shirts from Revenge of the Nerds, I suppose. Famous T-shirts of the 80s. Famous fictional T-shirts of the 80s. But, yeah, you can probably get I Heart Toxic Waste and Surf Nicaragua at your local Urban Outfitters now.
So this is one of those interesting how things have changed, not the internet, but correcting things. When I saw this movie, which would have been for the first time, like 15 years ago, the kid's name, Gabe Jarrett's name, was misspelled in the credits. They've since fixed that on the DVD. But I remember reading an interview with him around, because he was in like Apollo 13, and they spelled his name right. And so he was like, yeah, it was hard for me to get work because they kept spelling my name wrong. And so nobody knew, like, nobody could get a hold of me because it didn't match my, you know, SAG card or something.
How did they misspell it?
It used to be spelled with an extra T.
Oh. I think that Gabriel was misspelled. And
he was Gabe for his first couple of movies. But I mean, he did nothing after this. And he was kind of like, well, what Chris Makepeace got roles as a geek. You'd think this kid could get roles as a geek.
Right.
Yeah. What else to talk about? I mean, it's the music's good. It's really,
The music is basically like, Thomas Newman copying his Revenge of the Nerds score, but that's a good thing.
And, yeah, I mean, it gets over its bumps. I mean, it's kind of bumpy with John Grease living in the steam tunnels because,
well, he doesn't have much of a point.
I always have a problem with that scene where Gabe Jarrett goes into he discovers it and he takes the ride down. And he sees John Grease there. I have two problems with it. First, that it needed to be clear that it's somehow reset. Because it was a one-way trip. It was like you're riding a train car in one direction. There was no setup for how it he turns around and goes through the other way.
Yeah.
So I've always had a problem with that. But, I mean, it's like you're nitpicking at this point. It's a minute and 20 seconds in the movie.
Yeah. I have a nitpick.
Okay.
How did these supposed teen geniuses not figure that, like, in the Cold War 80s that this laser that they're working on wasn't going to be used for, like, destructive purposes? You know, it seems highly irregular. It would be like developing, I don't know, plutonium and not expecting it to be used – well, expecting it to be used for peaceful purposes. I mean, did they ever even say what they thought this laser was going to be used for if not zapping commies from space?
Yeah, there's this scene where they're like, what'd you think it was going to be used for? And they're just like, huh? Because it doesn't work. You can't include that kind of thing because it kills that moment of them – being grown-ups and realizing that, you know, the world is not a nice place. And I think that we should talk about the opening credits because I always forget them.
Well, they're really they're almost from a different movie because they open with, like, what, close-up schematics and designs of
weapons. Yeah.
Oh, of weapons, that's right. And there's, like, some old-timey jazz song playing, you know, whose lyrics are ironically counterposed to the images of destruction on screen. And it makes it seem like this movie is this big anti-war statement. And for the first few minutes, it really is, because you've just got, like, these Pentagon guys who barely show up in the rest of the movie, just kind of evilly plot the plot for the rest of the movie to develop this laser.
And that scene is so awkward that you almost wonder if they decided while they were filming, well, let's give it we need to include this subplot. So they shot the beginning and wrote it in.
Yeah.
Because otherwise I think you still could have had a comedy if you had concentrated just on the character drama. You could have still had a comedy.
Oh, yeah. And there's a great comedy. There's a great comedy in here, you know, just kind of bookended by this stupid Cold War stuff.
Yeah, the opening credits look like it's like Deal of the Century or something, that Chevy Chase arms dealer movie that nobody ever saw. Yeah, it just makes no sense.
Or Lord of War, that Nicolas Cage arms dealer movie that nobody saw. People don't like arms dealer movies. I keep saying it over and over.
If they did those credits for Lord of War, I bet, you know, it would make up for Jared Leto being in it, or Michelle Monaghan, or whichever Monaghan's terrible, Bridget Monaghan. But it's because there's this whole subplot, or not even subplot, because that's what's I like so much about Real Geniuses is the way that the plot develops. It's completely unexpected. Even if, you know, you haven't seen it in 15 years, there are certain details that are unexpected. Like Val Kilmer gets into it with William Atherton, and William Atherton's like, I'm just going to fail you. He's like, I don't care. And so Val Kilmer then has to work hard and, like, try and passes stuff, so it turns into the genius studying and things like that, and it's just interesting how that whole thing works. And then pretty soon after that, the military thing comes right back in.
Yeah. How about, you know, the after William Atherton tells him that he's gonna, like, fail him no matter what, Val Kilmer and Gabriel have, you know, their heart-to-heart scene that I mentioned earlier. I think my favorite – that's a great scene, but I think my favorite thing about it is the unbelievably phony nighttime backdrop with the super fake light bulb moon hanging between their heads.
Yeah, you get the feeling there were some filming issues because, I mean, there's that daytime scene, the first scene at school, and the school never looks like that again. Like, there are these stairs. One of the other things I really liked was that in the romance with Michelle
Mirnick.
Mirnick.
Marink.
the way that they work in that she's really a lot older than Gabe Jarrett, it's just it just adds so much texture to the movie. It, you don't get this in a comedy anymore, because when it's in a Wes Anderson movie, they draw to, he draws a lot of attention to it. But here it's all very subtle, and probably because, you know, it was an 80s comedy, and they were like, you're going to be the next Ghostbusters, or you're never going to work again, Martha Coolidge.
Well, wait, what does that mean? What are they threatening Martha Coolidge with, making the next Ghostbusters?
I would, I, now that I see that it came out from, you know, well, wait, this was TriStar. Did Sony own TriStar back then?
I don't think so.
It just feels like people were expecting this to be a big hit.
Yeah, well, you know, they certainly dropped cash on it for those freaking laser effects.
The terrible poster was like, you could just tell, like, the scrambling of someone to try and... Okay, so no, TriStar was a...
What?
TriStar was actually like an a conglomerate studio. It was funded by Columbia Pictures, HBO, and CBS.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's probably very interesting. But anyway, so, I mean, I guess there would be some sort of a Columbia connection to it. But no, you just feel like, and they got William Atherton in it because they're like, hey, it's, it just feels like something stupid they do today. Like when, what was his face? Jonah Hill was supposed to be in Transformers 2 playing, you know, the obnoxious fat friend like he was in Superbad. It's like, hey, you like Superbad, so see Transformers 2. Yeah.
Well, you know, if they were really banking on William Atherton that much, I don't think they would have had to had him shave his beard. I think they would have had him keep it so that everybody knew it was Walter Peck.
I've never heard that you can't recognize him. It's because I've probably saw Die Hard so much that I just...
He's got a... Yeah, okay. I guess if I haven't seen Die Hard enough
times.
He's got
that fluffy hair. He's got very fluffy hair, and that's like one of the weird things. I don't know what he looked like in Day of the Locust, but in...
He basically like he does in this.
In Sugarland, he had his hair matted down, and like every 80s movie he's in, he's got a very puffy hair that you can just see the... They're just like, we can use some more hairspray if we want to get it up higher, yeah.
Yeah. Well, he was hardly alone in that... In the arena of hairspray abuse during the 1980s, so lay off poor Willie Atherton. I'm sure we're almost out of time, but there's one more thing that I want to mention, which is that this is probably the first movie to use "Everybody Wants to Rule the World" by Tears for Fears in its soundtrack. I mean, not that a ton of movies have done that, but. I mean, this is like about, what, 10, you know, almost 10 years before Dennis Miller made the song famous again by making it the theme song of his HBO show. So, yeah, you know, for a little while, Real Genius kind of owned that song, you know, making it, you know, well, it rolls over the ending credits, so they definitely wanted it to be associated with the film. But, you know, I guess it works, but it only works because it ties the movie back to its, you know, Cold War, anti-Star Wars, anti-Pentagon kind of message. So, yeah, a little bit of trivia there. First movie to feature Everybody Wants to Rule the World.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the weird thing is seeing it when it wasn't. Seeing it years later, you wouldn't have realized that, and you would have seen Everybody Wants to Rule the World in at least three other movies.
Yeah. So, well, speaking of... speaking of...
Science, maybe?
Speaking of science, my science project.
Which you've never seen, right? You've never seen this.
I always wanted to, and now I wish I had. But, you know, I remember seeing, like, the cover to this at a Suncoast Video in some mall growing up, and just looking at the poster and thinking, this movie looks awesome, you know? You've got, like, these four high school stereotypes, and there's blue lightning flying all over the place. So, you know, we've got some 80s special effects, and it, you know, judging from the title and the poster, it kind of seems to be about science run amok, perhaps a weird science kind of film. And Dennis Hopper, you know, always a mark of quality when he's in a film. And oh boy, was this bad. This was really bad.
It's like Dennis Hopper selling his soul with this one long before he started selling it, you know.
This, yeah. You know, I wasn't really worried about how bad this movie was. Well, okay, I mean, it gets off to a really bad start because it opens with, like, the Roswell crash, basically. And it's in the 1950s, and this colonel or something shows up, and I'm not sure if he's supposed to be who is that guy? I Shall Return, MacArthur. I'm not sure if he's supposed to be General MacArthur or if they just dressed him like that, but there's this horrible throwaway line in the first, like, 2 minutes where, you know, some army guy is like, man, this is crazy. And then the guy says, nah, not as crazy as invading Europe. And you're just like, this is how the writer creates the context of history here. And I remember what you said when we were choosing this movie, that like this movie like was produced to be shown on afternoon, like Sunday afternoons on HBO. And I didn't know if you meant that literally or not. Like, cause like, you know, it got a theatrical release, but it's pretty much like a higher budgeted, Disney Channel original movie or something, or you know, or a premium cable kind of original movie for kids, because it's got these, you know, it's got blue lightning, you know, special effects and whatnot, and it's got an animatronic you know, rear projected dinosaur puppet at the end, and those are like the two big special effects. You know, lots of blue lightning, and you know, speaking of Ghostbusters, I mean, if you don't know what I'm talking about when I say blue lightning, it's just my favorite 80s special effect because it's so ubiquitous. It's just like optical, you know, wavy lines of lightning that fly all over everything. It was in big, it's all over the place in Big Trouble in Little China too. You know what I'm talking about if you know what I'm talking about. So this movie's got a lot of that. And then it's got a dinosaur at the end. And I think that was another thing that made me think this movie might be good, is that, like, I was looking – I remember as a kid looking at the back of the box and being like,
yeah, there's a dinosaur. I think I remember that box now. Yeah, there's just this weird picture of the dinosaur.
It just looks like a fun movie if you're a kid, you know?
And it's not.
I want to say that if I saw this movie as a kid, I would have liked it. But I don't know. I think even as a kid, I would have known it was – I think even as a kid, even if I would have liked it, like enjoyed it, I don't think I would have found it all that funny. And this movie's trying really hard to be funny, like excruciatingly hard with the one-liners. And I knew it was really – I knew the movie was really in trouble about, you know, 10 minutes in or so when we get introduced to Fisher Stevens. Fisher Stevens should be executed for his performance in this movie. Not because he's playing like an unfunny, you know, greaser Dago stereotype, and not because his character's like one trait is that he keeps making references to TV shows. And not even because he drops the fag and faggot bombs in what's supposed to be a PG kids movie, you know, paging Fred Decker. But oh heck, yeah, no, he should be put to death for all three of those things together.
I mean, yeah, you know? It's a
triple whammy. It's an astonishing in a movie full of bad performances. It's astonishingly bad.
Okay, so. The last John Stockwell movie I saw was Christine I watched this. He's really good in Christine. Like,
better than this anyway.
And so I thought he was going to be competent in this, right? And it's just like, right. No, because, and why is he incompetent? Because he's stuck with Fisher Stevens. I mean, the script's terrible. I mean, the script is really bad. I mean, there are probably half-hour cartoons that have better writing than this movie.
Yeah. You know what really doesn't work is how, like, you know, who wrote this piece of shit? What's his name? Jonathan R. Bachewel. He never even defines what the alien device is or what it can do or what it can't do. I guess it kind of just like it opens up portals in space and time, and that's it. But you know, that doesn't explain why, like, the first thing that the device starts doing that's creating a disaster is like sucking up all the town's electricity. I mean, there's no explanation why
it
needs
power. Obviously. You know,
right, it needs power. And then you have this incredibly idiotic scene where John Stockwell and Fisher Stevens and the girl are trying to outrun the alien lightning as it's sucking, you know, the blue lightning is like shooting down the power lines and sucking up all the power. So John Stockwell, it's like every character in this movie has exactly one trait, maybe like one and a half. And John Stockwell's trait is that he's a gearhead. He loves cars, right? So that comes into play because he has to outrun this blue lightning that's sucking up the energy. And I mean, like, what? You can't outrun lightning in your fucking car, even if you're going like, you know, 90 miles an hour or whatever that they show the speedometer at. That's idiotic. I mean, it's not even, and even if like even if John Bethuel's excuse was that this was a kid's movie, like, you know, don't give kids the wrong idea. They don't teach kids that they can outrun electricity, because they can't. It's going to give them some bad ideas about the world.
Well, and one of the weird things about this movie is the special effects aren't bad. Like that scene that we're talking about now. It's a pretty good desert special effects. I mean, it's clearly a mix of, I mean, they're mixing miniatures and they're mixing the light, and it works. You know, it's early, probably not CG, but I mean, whatever.
I noticed Rick Baker in the credits, actually. He like helped design the dinosaur that shows up at the end.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't know if there's any budgetary information on this, but it was advertised as, and this is on the movie poster. So the movie poster announced it as the funniest sci-fi movie of the summer. And
I mean, you were talking about, you know, post-Ghostbusters films vis-a-vis Real Genius. I mean, my science project is a real post-Ghostbusters film.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just the poster, the cover that I was talking about, you know, that attracted me as a kid is basically the Ghostbusters poster. It's like the three or four of them standing around holding weapons, kind of looking up to the sky, and there's smoke and blue lightning everywhere.
Well, according
like that's the Ghostbusters poster.
To something, its alternate title overseas was like a mix of Ghostbusters and something else. And then, what's this trivia say? Cine Fantastique magazine at the time talked about how there were alien puppets for the opening sequence, which they would have then killed the aliens because the military was bad in both My Science Project and Real Genius. Yeah. But so this wasn't cheap. I mean, it was, you know, they spent some money on this. And I think that I assume it's because Last Starfighter was... Was it a hit or was it just?
I think it was.
I mean, I liked it when I was six. I couldn't watch it the last time I tried. I mean, it wasn't actually that big of a hit. It didn't even do double its budget, but people really liked it. I think it was a.
Well, I kind of, you know, I think the reason I would have liked this as a kid is probably the reason I would have liked The Last Starfighter as a kid. Basically that it's, you know, stream of consciousness kid fantasy logic. Like, what if the arcade machine was really a training manual for a real alien war, and then the aliens picked you up and you got to fight in the real war? Or what if you found a piece of alien technology and, you know, your science teacher was crazy and it made him disappear, and then you were like running around and it was opening up, you know, wormholes in time, and Vikings were coming out, and then a dinosaur comes out, you know? Like, this is all real appealing stream of consciousness stupidity, but it takes wit to do that and have it not be insulting to people over the age of 8. And my science project can't pull it off.
What wasn't there another 80s movie where Vikings show up?
Time Bandits?
Yeah, Time Bandits. So, I mean, it's like, so my science project is derivative of it's derivative of stuff that people had already seen. I mean, it's just
it's derivative of stuff that people saw at the Spencer's gift store, and I'm referring to the stupid lightning ball thing that we've all seen, you know, where you put your finger on it and the lightning goes up to your finger. Like, that's the engine of this mysterious alien technological device.
Yeah,
it's lame. It's not good.
But I did like the romance between.
Well, you know, in a movie as full of shit as this, you know, it stood out a little bit as not being completely offensive.
But also in a very, you know, movie for 10-year-olds kind of way, that you're not supposed to judge someone by the size of her glasses. But
right.
We got to talk about the terrible cop and then the freaky dad situation.
I kind of blocked out the dad situation, I guess, but yeah, there's this terrible Stacy Keach-esque cop who shows up basically to effect nothing, but, you know, to arrest John Stockwell and Fisher Stevens, and then in one of many idiotic scenes, like, the lights flicker on and off, and in the ensuing confusion, these two teenagers run out of a police station full of cops. But yeah, the cop played by Richard Masur, Detective Isidore Nolte, he's pretty unfunny. what was the thing with the dad?
Okay, so the dad, it's Barry Corbin from Northern Exposure, and I don't know what he did in the '80s, but he got famous on Northern Exposure, and so he's recognizable. But then the dad like moves in this woman, and it's his girlfriend. Or first it's like she's the neighbor, and then she's like the girlfriend, and then she's like moving in, and then they're like getting married, and it all happens in the span of a day and a half, and you can just tell that Butel's like, it's going to be really funny because like it's accelerated and it's and you're just kind of like, it's like naming Richard Mauser's character Isidore Nolte. It's just
Well, you know what really kills this movie just on the character level is that like this is a 90-minute movie, but these characters are written with less dimension than sitcom characters. I mean, I'm not kidding when they say that like everybody has like 1.5 character traits maximum, and like that just kills it on a character level because it's a 90-minute movie and these characters don't even have as much dimension as sitcom characters. And what's even more annoying is that, you know, before the weird stuff starts happening, like in the first 20 minutes or so of just setting up Fisher Stevens and John Stockwell and the other kids, it's like John Bachule seems to think that he's doing like a John Hughes movie. He seems to think like he's really depicting teenagers the way mm-hmm. that they are, with some kind of, you know, warmth and honesty. But I don't know, man. It's really rough going, and we haven't even gotten into Dennis Hopper's character. But before I forget, I was just looking at the credits of my science project, and I was wrong. It wasn't General MacArthur who shows up at the beginning of the movie in the prologue. It's President Eisenhower.
And I always wondered, how much makeup did they put the guy in, or is that just what he looked like? We also haven't talked about Raphael Sparge as the nerd. We're, like, missing that subplot of that there's a nerd who likes the girl, So John Stockwell. Oh God, this movie's so bad. Sorry, I'm just remembering Fisher Stevens. But so, I mean, that's the other thing is Fisher Stevens was successful after this for a couple of years, right? Like he got jobs after this. He was in what, Short Circuit? Was that it? Yes, the next thing he did was Short Circuit. And that like his career took off for a full 5 years, maybe 5 years. But yeah, so then there's this Raphael Sparge, and he's in it. And all the guy had done before this was, and he plays
he plays a nerd, but I mean, he looks way too old to be in high school.
He looks way too old to be in high school. He's a nerd, but he's also, he's more stereotypical than any of the jokes in Revenge of the Nerds. I mean, it's just like, they were like, he can have him just like, you can't even understand why they exaggerated it to this point.
Right.
Because I would say that, I mean, Fisher Stevens' character is not supposed to actually be cool. So I guess Fisher Stevens would be a geek and the other guy would be a nerd, but they don't have any characters in it to sort of ground it like that. But yeah, and then he actually conspires with the police detective to get them in trouble at some point.
Right, but then he helps them at the end beat the dinosaur.
Yes, the dinosaur. Okay, so Dennis Hopper.
Yeah, oh boy. Well, first of all, I have to wonder if David Lynch saw this before he made Blue Velvet, because Dennis Hopper's character in this does huff from an oxygen mask to like calm his nerves, which is very Frank Booth-ish. So you have to wonder, maybe that was just Dennis Hopper's thing and he brought it to more than one movie. But yeah, it's you feel embarrassed for Dennis Hopper because like he's so obviously trading. You know, this is like 1 year before Blue Velvet, and all he can do is trade on his infamy and his iconic status as the zonked out refugee from the hippies or from the 60s, which is, you know, he's playing a science teacher who's obviously an ex-hippie. And then he has two really embarrassing standout scenes later. They turn the machine on and it's just shooting blue lightning all over the place. And Dennis Hopper is just like waving his hands through it and rambling about how this is like cosmic energy and he's touching the infinite void and, you know, hippie babble like that. And then he gets zapped out and mercifully disappears for most of the rest of the movie. But then he has this really, when he comes back, it's even more embarrassing because it's just this, it's all been a long setup to a joke where he comes back from the machine and he's been to the 60s and he's talking and he's going like, Woodstock, Beatles concerts, fight the power, man. And, you know, the unfunny cop isn't having any of it and he's calling him a yippie. And then there's this really poorly dubbed over line where Dennis Hopper obviously drops the F bomb, but they had to dub it over to something less innocuous, or more innocuous. And,
I mean, Dennis Hopper, of course, then a few years later made Flashback, where he did, I guess, the same thing.
Oh, yeah. He wasn't done doing that, even after Blue Velvet.
No, but what's really funny is I just was reading about, in one of his obits, they talked about his drug addiction problems. And according to the timeline, Dennis Hopper was actually clean for my science project. Which, you know, I mean, if you've seen movies made in the 50s and 60s, you see actors working for liquor money. And right. I mean, at least you could have respected it as that he had a problem and he was fueling his addiction. No, yeah. According to Dennis Hopper, he was sober when he made this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. This is kind of random, but you know, when the T-Rex shows up at the end of the movie, I think this is the only movie in history, maybe not, but it's certainly, you know, It's certainly one of those pre-Jurassic Park movies where a Tyrannosaurus actually leans over and picks someone up with his useless little appendage arms. I love that. Because there's no way a T-Rex could lean all the way over, pick someone up with its useless little arms without like completely falling over on its face.
Yeah. But
in my science project, it does.
It's kind of, yeah, it yeah, the T-Rex scene, I don't want to say I was looking forward to it, but I was like...
What else was there to look forward to?
I was like, at one point I'm like, when the hell... And with my science project, you're checking the clock every, 3 minutes. You're like, oh, shit, really? There's another 37 minutes.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, where's the T-Rex? And so I vaguely remembered that there was a T-Rex. I'd forgotten Fisher Stevens. I'd forgotten Eisenhower. And I also forgot the terrible scene at the school where, the school is time shifting or something. So there's all these guys they have to fight, like future mutants. So there's a scene where they're fighting the future mutants from the last,
Starfighter.
Not the last Starfighter. The last Planet of the Apes movie. It looks just like them, and you're just wow.
Oh yeah, and then like Fisher Stevens kicks a caveman in the balls. Yeah. Also, what makes the pace of this movie kind of interminable is that it literally takes like half the running time before they turn the alien device on. Well, I guess like in the first 20 minutes, they're setting up the characters. And then in the next 20 minutes, they're having to steal the thing from, some abandoned aircraft field. And then right about at the halfway point, they show the device to Dennis Hopper and he turns it on and blue lightning flies everywhere. And he disappears. Excuse me. And then finally, like in the second half of the movie, you've got all the stuff that presumably you came to see, all of the idiotic, chasing the blue lightning down the power lines and time holes opening up type of stuff. But I mean, everything that we were saying about the one-dimensional characters and the horrible jokes, I mean, that goes on for the whole first half of the movie before anything even kind of science fiction-like happens, So for the first half of the movie, you're just stuck in this incompetently written teenage sitcom. And, it only marginally improves when blue lightning is flying all over the place.
Yeah, I think the first scene is supposed to give you the sci-fi aspect of it. And what's funny is that I also felt a little like it was a post Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh, sure. Well, the fact that they've, got this thing stowed away in a crate somewhere and nobody knows about
it. But the more interesting thing, of course, is that, then Indiana Jones 4 did sort of do this. Maybe Lucas saw my science project, too. And Blue Lightning, of course, the first major 80s use was the Emperor.
Right.
In Return of the Jedi, ripping off Sleeping Beauty. But, well, actually, I don't know if it's a ripoff. It's an homage. We'll give Lucas the benefit of the doubt there. But, then you get the terrible... And they're in, like, some desert community in the middle of nowhere, maybe. It seems like that, but it's never really defined where they are. Yeah, it's just... Well, Jonathan R. Butel, I think the only thing he ever did after this was Theodore Rex...
Enough said.
Which, of course, was the first incredibly $35 million direct-to-video movie. I don't think people try to do that anymore. But you got to realize that that was at the point where, like, $15 million of that went to Whoopi Goldberg. Filming locations. So, yeah, it did film in Tucson, Arizona.
I like how his directing credits are Theodore Rex, My Science Project, an episode of CBS Summer Playhouse, and two episodes of Freddy's Nightmares.
Freddy's Nightmares, very popular show, and...
Those are also his writing credits, coincidentally, plus The Last Starfighter.
The Last Starfighter. People love it. But, yeah, I mean, it, yeah, I don't even know if I know anybody who's ever seen Theodore Rex.
No, I haven't thought about it in a long time. I think it was on Monster Vision maybe once or twice. But any case.
What else?
What else is there to say about my science project? You know, the good girl that, you know, that the nerd has a crush on and that John Stockwell ends up, you know, getting with despite the awkward size of her glasses. She reminds me a little of like Kathy Ireland in Alien from L.A., where she's having to play, you know, a nerdy, awkward, whiny girl with big glasses, but then she takes them off and, you know, the cliche. But, you know, in a weird way, it's kind of because her character isn't written at all. Like, she's the most well-developed character just because that actress got to, you know, respond to things the way that she probably would have. Like, her character is underwritten, so she can't give a lot of terrible jokes like Fisher Stevens.
Yeah.
Making her the most tolerable character.
There's one thing I noticed that I'd never seen before. This movie is from the producer of Mean Streets.
Wow.
The guy who produced Mean Streets produced this.
Huh.
And it was one of the early Touchstone movies.
Oh, I noticed that too. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a very early Touchstone movie.
I'll bet Disney was, you know, reviewing the print and they were thinking about whether or not this was going to have the Disney name, and then Fisher Stevens, you know, calls someone a faggot, and they're just like, oh shit, we gotta make this Touchstone. We gotta cover our asses here.
Yeah, I mean, it's like,
it's bad enough Dennis Hopper obviously says fuck at the end of the movie, and we just have to awkwardly dub over it.
Yeah. And so,
how fucking in love was John Bachule with Fisher Stevens that like he had to put his outtakes during the credits? That's like the final turn of the knife with this movie.
Oh,
is that
God, I know.
Like in the ending credits, at first it's just like still frames from throughout the movie, which is lame enough, you know, unnecessary and lame and pointless. But then, but then the still frames come to life and it's Fisher Steven gags that couldn't make it into the rest of the movie.
Well, I mean, who knows? Maybe they knew he was going to be a big hit, right? I mean, my science project.
Yes.
Okay, so I was right. Now, my science project is now out on DVD from Touchstone. It's out from Disney somewhere, right? But all of these Disney movies before, they licensed them all to Anchor Bay. So,
yeah.
But Anchor Bay sadly did not do a special edition with commentary, which would have just been enlightening.
Blue lightning.
In fact, the Anchor Bay box cover has a lot of blue lightning and Fisher. And I, the copy that I saw did not have Dennis Hopper, but the Anchor Bay one has Dennis Hopper acting like the Emperor with blue lightning on theirs. And it goes for $82 new on Amazon.
Wow.
But there's no special features except a pan and scan copy of it.
Hmm.
Yeah. My science project. Wow. What else?
Does that about do it for my science project?
I think it does, but I think we forgot to mention why it's called my science project.
Why is it called my science project?
Because Dennis Hopper's going to fail John Stockwell.
Yeah.
And so his solution is to break into the Air Force base we mentioned earlier and just steal something and turn it in.
Right.
And that's gonna pass him. What's actually more interesting is if you search for my science project on Amazon, you get a list of all the related items.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so here are the movies that it does, and this will be our final. This is what, according to Amazon search statistics, Real Genius is the first one. Then The Wrath with Charlie Sheen, which would have come out a few years later, right? 80s sci-fi.
Yeah.
Weird Science a few years earlier. Night of the Comet. Ice Pirates. Last Starfighter. Explorers.
Oh, Explorers is a great movie.
And then Flight of the Navigator toward the end. Yeah, I mean,
Flight of the Navigator is not a great movie, but it's better than My Science Project.
Yeah, so now you've seen My Science Project. Now you know why everybody's...
Yeah. Are you sure that wasn't The Wraith with Charlie Sheen?
Is it The Wraith or The Wrath?
I think it's The Wraith.
That's neither here nor there, though.
All right, so I'm excising this movie from my memory now, except for that awesome Tyrannosaurus Rex. Because it's really no movie with a Tyrannosaurus Rex, and it can be completely worthless. See also Clifford with Martin Short. Anyways, our next episode is a commentary track, and I think we might be alternating these from now on, you know, double feature, commentary track, double feature. So our next episode's another commentary track, and it's for a flick which I have not seen, so it'll be new on me. And you've seen several versions of it, but
several.
We can only watch one version, and we're watching some version of Supergirl from 1984, the attempt to expand the Superman franchise after Superman 3, which did not go too good. And most people would probably be surprised if you told them that there is a Supergirl movie. But there is, and we're going to watch it.
With commentary.
So
and you're going to see what happens when Faye Dunaway's career just goes.
When Faye Dunaway's career is done away.
Hey, perfect. There you go.
All right. So join us, won't you? And for an Alan Smithy podcast, this has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
And thanks for listening.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of the Best of an Alan Smithy podcast. This is Claire Steiner. Good evening.